was on the wrong side of the post, but I trusted to things coming round. That very popular trust in flat things coming round, not in their being beaten round or worked round, but in their coming round, as though a lunatic should trust in the world's coming triangular. "I had confident expectations that things would come round and be all square," says Mr. Jobling, with some vagueness of expression, and perhaps of meaning too. "But I was disappointed. They never did. And when it came to creditors making rows at the office, and to people that the office dealt with making complaints about dirty trifles of borrowed money, well, there was an end of that connection, and of any new professional connection too. For if I was to give a reference tomorrow, it would be mentioned and would sew me up. Then what's a fellow to do? I've been keeping out of the way and living cheap down about the market gardens. But what's the use of living cheap when you've got no money? You might as well live dear." "Better," Mr. Smallweed thinks. "Certainly it's the fashionable way. And fashion and whiskers have been my weaknesses, and I don't care who knows it," says Mr. Jobling. "They are great weaknesses, demmy, sir, they are great." "Well," proceeds Mr. Jobling, after a defiant visit to his rum and water, "what can a fellow do, I ask you, but enlist?" Mr. Gubby comes more fully into the conversation to state what, in his opinion, a fellow can do. His manner is the gravely impressive manner of a man who has not committed himself in life otherwise than as he has become the victim of a tender sorrow of the heart. "Jobling," says Mr. Guppy, "myself and our mutual friend Smallweed," Mr. Smallweed modestly observes, "gentlemen both," and drinks, "have had a little conversation on this matter more than once since you—"
"Say, got the sack," cries Mr. Jobling bitterly. "Say it, Guppy, you mean it?"
"No, left the inn," Mr. Smallweed delicately suggests. "Since you left the inn, Jobling," says Mr. Guppy, "and I have mentioned to our mutual friend Smallweed a plan I have lately thought of proposing. You know Snagsby the stationer?"
"Oh, no, there is such a stationer," returns Mr. Jobling. "He was not ours, and I'm not acquainted with him."
"He is ours, Jobling, and I am acquainted with him," Mr. Guppy retorts. "Well, sir, I've lately become better acquainted with him through some accidental circumstances that have made me a visitor of his in private life. Those circumstances it is not necessary to offer in argument. They may, or they may not, have some reference to a subject which may, or may not, have cast its shadow on my existence." As it is Mr. Guppy's perplexing way with boastful misery to tempt his particular friends into this subject, and the moment they touch it to turn on them with that trenchant severity about the chords in the human mind, both Mr. Jobling and Mr. Smallweed decline the pitfall by remaining silent. "Such things may be," repeats Mr. Guppy, "or they may not be. They are no part of the case. It is enough to mention that both Mr. and Mrs. Snagsby are very willing to oblige me, and that Snagsby has, in busy times, a good deal of copying work to give out. He has all Tulkinghorn's, and an excellent business besides. I believe if our mutual friend Smallweed were put into the box, he could prove this." Mr. Smallweed nods, and appears greedy to be sworn. "Now, gentlemen of the jury," says Mr. Guppy, "I mean, now, Jobling, you may say this is a poor prospect of a living, granted, but it's better than nothing, and better than enlistment. You want time? There must be time for these late affairs to blow over. You might live through it on much worse terms than by writing for Snagsby." Mr. Jobling is about to interrupt when the sagacious Smallweed checks him with a dry cough and the words,
"Ahem, Shakespeare."
"There are two branches to this subject, Jobling," says Mr. Guppy. "That is the first. I'll come to the second. You know Crook, the Chancellor across the lane?" "Come, Jobling," says Mr. Guppy in his encouraging cross-examination tone. "I think you know Crook, the Chancellor, across the lane."
"I know him by sight," says Mr. Jobling.
"You know him by sight. Very well. And you know Little Flight?"
"Everybody knows her,"
says Mr. Jobling. "Everybody knows her. Very well. Now, it has been one of my duties of late to pay Flight a certain weekly allowance, deducting from it the amount of her weekly rent, which I have paid, in consequence of instructions I have received, to Crook himself regularly in her presence. This has brought me into communication with Crook, and into a knowledge of his house and his habits. I know he has a room to let. You may live there at a very low charge under any name you like, as quietly as if you were 100 miles off. He'll ask no questions, and would accept you as a tenant at a word from me, before the clock strikes, if you choose.
And I'll tell you another thing, Jobling, says Mr. Guppy, who has suddenly lowered his voice and become familiar again. He's an extraordinary old chap, always rummaging among a litter of papers and grubbing away at teaching himself to read and write without getting on a bit, as it seems to me.
He is a most extraordinary old chap, sir. I don't know but what it might be worth a fellow's while to look him up a bit.
You don't mean...
Mr. Jobling begins.
I mean, returns Mr. Guppy, shrugging his shoulders with becoming modesty, that I can't make him out. I appeal to our mutual friend Smallweed whether he has or has not heard me remark that I can't make him out.
Mr. Smallweed bears the concise testimony. A few.
I have seen something of the profession and something of life, Tony, says Mr. Guppy, and it's seldom I can't make a man out, more or less. But such an old card as this, so deep, so sly and secret, though I don't believe he's ever sober, I never came across. Now, he must be precious old, you know, and he has not a soul about him, and he is reported to be immensely rich. And whether he is a smuggler, or a receiver, or an unlicensed pawnbroker, or a moneylender, all of which I have thought likely at different times, it might pay you to knock up a sort of knowledge of him. I don't see why you shouldn't go in for it when everything else suits.
Mr. Jobling, Mr. Guppy, and Mr. Smallweed all lean their elbows on the table and their chins upon their hands, and look at the ceiling. After a time, they all drink, slowly lean back, put their hands in their pockets, and look at one another.
If I had the energy I once possessed, Tony, says Mr. Guppy with a sigh, but there are chords in the human mind.
Expressing the remainder of the desolate sentiment in rum and water, Mr. Guppy concludes by resigning the adventure to Tony Jobling and informing him that during the vacation and while things are slack, his purse, as far as 3 or 4, even 5 pound goes, will be at his disposal. For never shall it be said, Mr. Guppy adds with emphasis, that William Guppy turned his back upon his friend. The latter part of the proposal is so directly to the purpose that Mr. Jobling says with emotion,
"Guppy, my trump, your fist!"
Mr. Guppy presents it, saying, "Jobling, my boy, there it is." Mr. Jobling returns,
"Guppy, we've been pals now for some years."
Mr. Guppy replies, "Jobling, we have." They then shake hands, and Mr. Jobling adds in a feeling manner,
"Thank you, Guppy. I don't know what, but I will take another glass for old acquaintance' sake."
"Crook's last lodger died there," observes Mr. Guppy, in an incidental way.
"Did he, though?" says Mr. Jobling.
"There was a verdict. Accidental death. You don't mind that?"
"No," says Mr. Jobling. "I don't mind it. But he might as well have died somewhere else. It's devilish odd that he need go and die at my place."
Mr. Jobling quite resents this liberty, and several times returning to it with such remarks as,
"There are places enough to die in, I should think," or, "He wouldn't have liked my dying at his place, I dare say."
However, the compact being virtually made, Mr. Guppy proposes to dispatch the trusty Smallweed to ascertain if Mr. Crook is at home, as in that case they may complete the negotiation without delay. Mr. Jobling approving, Smallweed puts himself under the tall hat, and conveys it out of the dining-rooms in the Guppy manner. He soon returns with the intelligence that Mr. Crook is at home, and that he has seen him through the shop door, sitting in the back premises, sleeping like 1 o'clock.
"Then I'll pay," says Mr. Guppy, "and we'll go and see him. Small, what will it be?"
Mr. Smallweed, compelling the attendance of the waitress with one hitch of his eyelash, instantly replies as follows.
4 veals and hams is 3, and 4 potatoes is 3, and 4, and 1 summer cabbage is 3 and 6, and 3 marrows is 4 and 6, and 6 breads is 5, and 3 cheshires is 5 and 3, and 4 half pints of 1/2 and 1/2 is 6 and 3, and 4 small rums is 8 and 3, and 3 pollies is 8 and 6, 8 and 6 in 1/2 a sovereign, polly and 18 pence out.
Not at all excited by these stupendous calculations, Smallweed dismisses his friend with a cool nod, and remains behind to take a little admiring notice of Polly, as opportunity may serve, and to read the daily papers, which are so very large in proportion to himself, shorn of his hat, that when he holds up the Times to run his eye over the columns, he seems to have retired for the night, and to have disappeared under the bedclothes. Mr. Guppy and Mr. Jobling repair to the Rag and Bottle shop, where they find Crook still sleeping like 1 o'clock,
That is to say, breathing stertorously with his chin upon his breast and quite insensible to any external sounds or even to gentle shaking. On the table beside him, among the usual lumber, stand an empty gin bottle and a glass. The unwholesome air is so stained with this liquor that even the green eyes of the cat upon her shelf, as they open and shut and glimmer on the visitors, look drunk.
"Hold up here," says Mr. Guppy, giving the relaxed figure of the old man another shake. "Mr. Crook! Hello, sir!"
But it would seem as easy to wake a bundle of old clothes, with a spirituous heat smouldering in it.
"Did you ever see such a stupor as he falls into between drink and sleep?" says Mr. Guppy.
"If this is his regular sleep,"
returns Jobling, rather alarmed,
"it'll last a long time one of these days, I'm thinking."
"It's always more like a fit than a nap," says Mr. Guppy, shaking him again.
"Hallo, your lordship!
Why, he might be robbed 50 times over.
Open your eyes!"
After much ado, he opens them, but without appearing to see his visitor or any other objects, though he crosses one leg on another and folds his hands, and several times closes and opens his parched lips, he seems to all intents and purposes as insensible as before.
"He's alive, at any rate," says Mr. Guppy. "How are you, my Lord Chancellor? I've brought a friend of mine, sir, on a little matter of business."
The old man still sits, often smacking his dry lips without the least consciousness. After some minutes he makes an attempt to rise. They help him up, and he staggers against the wall and stares at them.
"How do you do, Mr. Crook?" says Mr. Guppy in some discomfiture. "How do you do, sir? You're looking charming, Mr. Crook. I hope you're pretty well."
The old man, in aiming a purposeless blow at Mr. Guppy, or at nothing, feebly swings himself round and comes with his face against the wall. So he remains, for a minute or two, heaped up against it, and then staggers down the shop to the front door. The air, the movement in the court, the lapse of time, or the combination of these things recovers him. He comes back, pretty steadily, adjusting his fur cap on his head and looking keenly at them.
"Your servant, gentlemen. I've been dozing. Hi, I am hard to wake odd times."
"Rather so indeed, sir," responds Mr. Guppy.
"What? You've been a-trying to do it, have you?" says the suspicious Crook.
"Only a little," Mr. Guppy explains.
The old man's eye resting on the empty bottle, he takes it up, examines it, and slowly tilts it upside down.
"I say," he cries like the hobgoblin in the story, "somebody's been making free here."
"I assure you we found it so," says Mr. Guppy. "Would you allow me to get it filled for you?"
"Yes, certainly I would," cries Crook in high glee. "Certainly I would. Don't mention it. Get it filled next door. Sol's Arms. The Lord Chancellor's 14-penny. Bless you, they know me."
He so presses the empty bottle upon Mr. Guppy that that gentleman, with a nod to his friend, accepts the trust and hurries out, and hurries in again with the bottle filled. The old man receives it in his arms like a beloved grandchild, and pats it tenderly.
"But I say," he whispers, with his eyes screwed up after tasting it, "this ain't the Lord Chancellor's 14-penny. This is 18-penny.
"I thought you might like that better," says Mr. Guppy.
"You're a nobleman, sir," returns Crook, with another taste, and his hot breath seems to come towards them like a flame. "You're a baron of the land."
Taking advantage of this auspicious moment, Mr. Guppy presents his friend under the impromptu name of Mr. Weevil, and states the object of their visit. Crook, with his bottle under his arm, he never gets beyond a certain point of either drunkenness or sobriety, takes time to survey his proposed lodger and seems to approve of him.
"You'd like to see the room, young man?" he says. "Oh, it's a good room. Been whitewashed. Been cleaned down with soft soap and soda. Aye, it's worth twice the rent, letting alone my company when you want it, and such a cat to keep the mice away."
Commending the room after this manner, the old man takes them upstairs, where indeed they do find it cleaner than it used to be, and also containing some old articles of furniture which he has dug up from his inexhaustible stores. The terms are easily concluded, for the Lord Chancellor cannot be hard on Mr. Guppy, associated as he is with Kenge and Carboy, Jarndyce and Jarndyce, and other famous claims on his professional consideration. And it is agreed that Mr. Weevil shall take possession on the morrow. Mr. Weevil and Mr. Guppy then repair to Cook's Court, Cursitor Street, where the personal introduction of the former to Mr. Snagsby is effected, and, more important, the vote and interest of Mrs. Snagsby are secured.
They then report progress to the eminent Smallweed, waiting at the office in his tall hat for that purpose, and separate, Mr. Guppy explaining that he would terminate his little entertainment by standing treat at the play, but that there are chords in the human mind which would render it a hollow mockery. On the morrow, in the dusk of evening, Mr. Weevil modestly appears at Crook's, by no means incommoded with luggage, and establishes himself in his new lodging, where the two eyes in the shutters stare at him in his sleep, as if they were full of wonder. On the following day, Mr. Weevil, who is a handy, good-for-nothing kind of young fellow, borrows a needle and thread of Miss Flight, and a hammer of his landlord, and goes to work devising apologies for window curtains, and knocking up apologies for shelves, and hanging up his two teacups, milk-pot, and crockery sundries on a pennyworth of little hooks, like a shipwrecked sailor making the best of it. But what Mr. Weevil prizes most of all his few possessions, next after his light whiskers, for which he has an attachment that only whiskers can awaken in the breast of man, is a choice collection of copperplate impressions from that truly national work, The Divinities of Albion, or Galaxy Gallery of British Beauty, representing ladies of title and fashion in every variety of smirk that art, combined with capital, is capable of producing. With these magnificent portraits, unworthily confined in a bandbox during his seclusion among the market gardens, he decorates his apartment, and as the Galaxy Gallery of British Beauty wears every variety of fancy dress, plays every variety of musical instrument, fondles every variety of dog, ogles every variety of prospect, and is backed up by every variety of flower-pot and balustrade, the result is very imposing. But fashion is Mr. Weevil's, and it was Tony Jobling's weakness. To borrow yesterday's paper from the Sol's Arms of an evening and read about the brilliant and distinguished meteors that are shooting across the fashionable sky in every direction is unspeakable consolation to him. To know what member of what brilliant and distinguished circle accomplished the brilliant and distinguished feat of joining it yesterday, or contemplates the no less brilliant and distinguished feat of leaving it tomorrow, gives him a thrill of joy. To be informed what the Galaxy Gallery of British Beauty is about, and means to be about, and what Galaxy marriages are on the tapis, and what Galaxy rumours are in circulation, is to become acquainted with the most glorious destinies of mankind. Mr. Weevil reverts from this intelligence to the Galaxy portraits implicated, and seems to know the originals, and to be known of them. For the rest, he is a quiet lodger, full of handy shifts and devices as before mentioned, able to cook and clean for himself, as well as to carpenter, and developing social inclinations after the shades of evening have fallen on the court. At those times, when he is not visited by Mr. Guppy, or by a small light in his likeness quenched in a dark hat, he comes out of his dark room, where he has inherited the deal wilderness of desk bespattered with a rain of ink, and talks to Crook, or is very free, as they call it in court, commendingly, with any one disposed for conversation. Wherefore Mrs. Piper, who leads the court, is impelled to offer two remarks to Mrs. Perkins. Firstly, that if her Johnny was to have whiskers, she could wish him to be identically like that young man's. And secondly, "Mark my words, Mrs. Perkins, ma'am, and don't you be surprised, Lord bless you, if that young man comes in at last for old Crook's money." Chapter 21 The Smallweed Family. In a rather ill-favoured and ill-savoured neighbourhood, though one of its rising grounds bears the name of Mount Pleasant, the elfin Smallweed, christened Bartholomew, and known on the domestic hearth as Bart, passes that limited portion of his time on which the office and its contingencies have no claim. He dwells in a little narrow street, always solitary, shady, and sad, closely bricked in on all sides like a tomb, but where there yet lingers the stump of an old forest tree, whose flavour is about as fresh and natural as the Smallweed smack of youth. There has been only one child in the Smallweed family for several generations. Little old men and women there have been, but no child, until Mr. Smallweed's grandmother, now living, became weak in her intellect and fell, for the first time, into a childish state, with such infantine graces as a total want of observation, memory, understanding, and interest, and an eternal disposition to fall asleep over the fire and into it, Mr. Smallweed's grandmother has undoubtedly brightened the family. Mr. Smallweed's grandfather is likewise of the party. He is in a helpless condition as to his lower, and nearly so as to his upper, limbs, but his mind is unimpaired,
It holds, as well as it ever held, the first four rules of arithmetic, and a certain small collection of the hardest facts. In respect of ideality, reverence, wonder, and other such phrenological attributes, it is no worse off than it used to be. Everything that Mr. Smallweed's grandfather ever put away in his mind was a grub at first, and is a grub at last. In all his life he has never bred a single butterfly. The father of this pleasant grandfather, of the neighbourhood of Mount Pleasant, was a horny-skinned, two-legged, money-getting species of spider who spun webs to catch unwary flies and retired into holes until they were entrapped. The name of this old pagan's god was Compound Interest. He lived for it, married it, died of it. Meeting with a heavy loss in an honest little enterprise in which all the loss was intended to have been on the other side, he broke something necessary to his existence, therefore it couldn't have been his heart, and made an end of his career. As his character was not good, and he had been bred at a charity school in a complete course according to question and answer of those ancient people, the Amorites and Hittites, he was frequently quoted as an example of the failure of education. His spirit shone through his son, to whom he had always preached of going out early in life, and whom he made a clerk in a sharp scrivener's office at 12 years old. There the young gentleman improved his mind, which was of a lean and anxious character, and developing the family gifts, gradually elevated himself into the discounting profession. Going out early in life and marrying late, as his father had done before him, he too begat a lean and anxious-minded son, who in his turn, going out early in life and marrying late, became the father of Bartholomew and Judith Smallweed, twins. During the whole time consumed in the slow growth of this family tree, the house of Smallweed, always early to go out and late to marry, has strengthened itself in its practical character, has discarded all amusements, discountenanced all story-books, fairy-tales, fictions, and fables, and banished all levities whatsoever. Hence the gratifying fact that it has had no child born to it, and that the complete little men and women whom it has produced have been observed to bear a likeness to old monkeys with something depressing on their minds. At the present time, in the dark little parlour, certain feet below the level of the street, a grim, hard, uncouth parlour, only ornamented with the coarsest of baize table covers and the hardest of sheet-iron tea-trays, and offering in its decorative character no bad allegorical representation of Grandfather Smallweed's mind. Seated in two black horsehair porter's chairs, one on each side of the fireplace, the superannuated Mr. and Mrs. Smallweed while away the rosy hours. On the stove are a couple of trivets for the pots and kettles, which it is Grandfather Smallweed's usual occupation to watch. And projecting from the chimney-piece between them is a sort of brass gallows for roasting, which he also superintends when it is in action. Under the venerable Mr. Smallweed's seat, and guarded by his spindle legs, is a drawer in his chair, reported to contain property to a fabulous amount. Beside him is a spare cushion, with which he is always provided in order that he may have something to throw at the venerable partner of his respected age whenever she makes an allusion to money, a subject on which he is particularly sensitive.
"And where's Bart?"
Grandfather Smallweed inquires of Judy, Bart's twin sister.
"I ain't come in yet," says Judy.
"It's his tea-time, isn't it?"
"No."
"How much do you mean to say at once, then?"
10 minutes.
Eh?
10 minutes.
Loud on the part of Judy.
"Oh," says Grandfather Smallweed. 10 minutes.
Grandmother Smallweed, who has been mumbling and shaking her head at the trivets, hearing figures mentioned, connects them with money, and screeches like a horrible old parrot without any plumage,
"Ting, ting, pound notes!"
Grandfather Smallweed immediately throws the cushion at her.
"Drat you, be quiet,"
says the good old man. The effect of this act of jaculation is twofold. It not only doubles up Mrs. Smallweed's head against the side of her porter's chair and causes her to present, when extricated by her granddaughter, a highly unbecoming state of cap, but the necessary exertion recoils on Mr. Smallweed himself, whom it throws back into his porter's chair like a broken puppet. The excellent old gentleman, being at these times a mere clothes bag, and a black skull cap on the top of it, does not present a very animated appearance, until he has undergone the two operations at the hands of his granddaughter of being shaken up like a great bottle, and poked and punched like a great bolster. Some indication of a neck being developed in him by these means, he and the sharer of his life's evening again fronting one another in their two porter's chairs, like a couple of sentinels long forgotten on their post by the black sergeant, Death. Judy, the twin, is worthy company for these associates. She is so indubitably sister to Mr. Smallweed, the younger, that the two kneaded into one would hardly make a young person of average proportions, while she so happily exemplifies the before-mentioned family likeness to the monkey tribe, that attired in a spangled robe and cap, she might walk about the tableland on the top of a barrel organ without exciting much remark as an unusual specimen. Under existing circumstances, however, she is dressed in a plain, spare gown of brown stuff. Judy never owned a doll, never heard of Cinderella, never played at any game. She once or twice fell into children's company when she was about 10 years old, but the children couldn't get on with Judy, and Judy couldn't get on with them. She seemed like an animal of another species, and there was instinctive repugnance on both sides. It is very doubtful whether Judy knows how to laugh. She has so rarely seen the thing done that the probabilities are strong the other way. Of anything like a youthful laugh, she certainly can have no conception. If she were to try one, she would find her teeth in the way, modelling that action of her face, as she has unconsciously modelled all its other expressions on her pattern of sordid age. Such is Judy. And her twin brother couldn't wind up a top for his life. He knows no more of Jack the Giant Killer, or of Sinbad the Sailor, than he knows of the people in the stars. He could as soon play at leapfrog or at cricket as change into a cricket or a frog himself. But he is so much the better off than his sister that on his narrow world of fact an opening has dawned into such broader regions as lie within the ken of Mr. Guppy. Hence his admiration and his emulation of that shining enchanter. Judy, with a gong-like clash and clatter, sets one of the sheet-iron tea-trays on the table and arranges cups and saucers. The bread she puts on in an iron basket, and the butter, and not much of it, in a small pewter plate. Grandfather Smallweed looks hard after the tea as it is served out, and asks Judy where the girl is.
"Charlie, do you mean?"
says Judy.
"Eh?"
says Grandfather Smallweed.
"Charlie, do you mean?"
This touches a spring in Grandmother Smallweed, who, chuckling as usual at the trivets, cries,
"Over the water! Charlie, over the water! Charlie, over the water! Over the water to Charlie! Charlie, over the water to Charlie!"
and becomes quite energetic about it. Grandfather looks at the cushion, but has not sufficiently recovered his late exertion.
"Ha!"
he says when there is silence.
"If that's her name, she eats a deal. It would be better to allow her for her keep."
Judy, with her brother's wink, shakes her head and purses up her mouth into no, without saying it.
"No,"
returns the old man.
"Why not?"
"She'd want sixpence a day, and we can do it for less," says Judy.
"Sure?"
Judy answers with a nod of deepest meaning, and calls, as she scrapes the butter on the loaf with every precaution against waste, and cuts it into slices,
"You, Charlie, where are you?"
Timidly obedient to the summons, a little girl in a rough apron and a large bonnet, with her hands covered with soap and water and a scrubbing brush in one of them, appears and curtsies.
"What work are you about now?"
says Judy, making an ancient snap at her like a very sharp old beldame.
"I'm a-cleaning the upstairs back room, miss,"
replies Charlie.
"Mind you do it thoroughly and don't loiter. Shirking won't do for me. Make haste. Go along,"
cries Judy, with a stamp upon the ground.
"You girls are more trouble than you're worth, by half."
On this severe matron, as she returns to her task of scraping the butter and cutting the bread, falls the shadow of her brother, looking in at the window, for whom, knife and loaf in hand, she opens the street door.
"Aye, aye, Bart," says Grandfather Smallweed,
"Here you are, hey?"
"Here I am," says Bart.
"Been along with your friend again, Bart?"
Small nods.
"Dining at his expense, Bart?"
Small nods again.
"That's right. Live at his expense as much as you can, and take warning by his foolish example. That's the use of such a friend. The only use you can put him to,"
says the venerable sage. His grandson, without receiving this good counsel as dutifully as he might, honours it with all such acceptance as may lie in a slight wink and a nod, and takes a chair at the tea-table. The four old faces then hover over teacups, like a company of ghastly cherubim, Mrs. Smallweed perpetually twitching her head and chattering at the trivets, and Mr. Smallweed requiring to be repeatedly shaken up like a large black draught.
"Yes, yes," says the good old gentleman, reverting to his lesson of wisdom. "That's such advice as your father would have given you, Bart. You never saw your father. More's the pity. He was my true son."
Whether it is intended to be conveyed that he was particularly pleasant to look at, on that account does not appear.
"He was my true son," repeats the old gentleman, folding his bread and butter on his knee. "A good accountant, and died 15 years ago."
Mrs. Smallweed, following her usual instinct, breaks out with,
£1,500, £1,500 in a black box, £1,500 locked up, £1,500 put away and hid."
Her worthy husband, setting aside his bread and butter, immediately discharges the cushion at her, crushes her against the side of her chair, and falls back in his own, overpowered. His appearance, after visiting Mrs. Smallweed with one of these admonitions, is particularly impressive and not wholly prepossessing, firstly because the exertion generally twists his black skull-cap over one eye, and gives him an air of goblin rakishness, secondly because he mutters violent imprecations against Mrs. Smallweed, and thirdly because the contrast between those powerful expressions and his powerless figure is suggestive of a baleful old malignant who would be very wicked if he could. All this, however, is so common in the Smallweed family circle that it produces no impression. The old man is merely shaken and has his internal feathers beaten up. The cushion is restored to its usual place beside him, and the old lady, perhaps with her cap adjusted and perhaps not, is planted in her chair again, ready to be bowled down like a ninepin. Some time elapses in the present instance before the old gentleman is sufficiently cool to resume his discourse, and even then he mixes it up with several edifying expletives addressed to the unconscious partner of his bosom, who holds communication with nothing on earth but the trivets. As thus,
"If your father, Bart, had lived longer, he might have been worth a deal of money, you brimstone chatterer. But just as he was beginning to build up the house that he had been making the foundations for through many a year, you jade of a magpie, jackdaw and poll parrot, what do you mean? He took ill and died of a low fever, always being a sparing and a spare man, full of business care. I should like to throw a cat at you instead of a cushion, and I will too if you make such a confounded fool of yourself. And your mother, who was a prudent woman as dry as a chip, just dwindled away like touchwood after you and Judy were born. You are an old pig, you are a brimstone pig, you are a head of swine."
Judy, not interested in what she has often heard, begins to collect in a basin various tributary streams of tea, from the bottoms of cups and saucers, and from the bottom of the teapot, for the little charwoman's evening meal. In like manner she gets together, in the iron bread-basket, as many outside fragments and worn-down heels of loaves as the rigid economy of the house has left in existence.
"But your father and me were partners, Bart," says the old gentleman, "and when I am gone, you and Judy will have all there is. It's rare for you both that you went out early in life, Judy to the flower business and you to the law. You won't want to spend it. You'll get your living without it, and put more to it. When I'm gone, Judy will go back to the flower business, and you'll still stick to the law."
One might infer from Judy's appearance that her business rather lay with the thorns than the flowers. but she has in her time been apprenticed to the art and mystery of artificial flower-making. A close observer might perhaps detect both in her eye and her brother's, when their venerable grandsire anticipates his being gone, some little impatience to know when he may be going, and some resentful opinion that it is time he went.
"Now, if everybody has done," says Judy, completing her preparations, "I'll have that girl in to her tea. She would never leave off if she took it by herself in the kitchen."
Charlie is accordingly introduced, and under a heavy fire of eyes sits down to her basin and a druidical ruin of bread and butter. In the active superintendence of this young person, Judy Smallweed appears to attain a perfectly geological age, and to date from the remotest periods. Her systematic manner of flying at her and pouncing on her, with or without pretence, whether or no, is wonderful, evincing an accomplishment in the art of girl-driving seldom reached by the oldest practitioners.
"Now, don't stare about you all the afternoon," cries Judy, shaking her head and stamping her foot as she happens to catch the glance which has been previously sounding the basin of tea, "but take your victuals and get back to your work."
"Yes, miss,"
says Charlie.
"Don't say yes," returns Miss Smallweed, "for I know what you girls are. Do it without saying it, and then I may begin to believe you."
Charlie swallows a great gulp of tea in token of submission, and so disperses the druidical ruins that Miss Smallwood charges her not to gormandize, which, "in you girls," she observes, "is disgusting." Charlie might find some more difficulty in meeting her views on the general subject of girls, but for a knock at the door.
"See who it is, and don't chew when you open it," cries Judy.
The object of her attentions, withdrawing for the purpose, Miss Smallweed takes that opportunity of jumbling the remainder of the bread and butter together, and launching two or three dirty teacups into the ebb tide of the basin of tea, as a hint that she considers the eating and drinking terminated.
"Now, who is it, and what's wanted?" says the snappish Judy.
It is one Mr. George, it appears. Without other announcement or ceremony, Mr. George walks in.
"Phew!" says Mr. George. "You are hot here. Always a fire, eh? Well, perhaps you do right to get used to one."
Mr. George makes the latter remark to himself, as he nods to Grandfather Smallweed.
"Oh, it's you," cries the old gentleman. "How d'ye do? How d'ye do?"
"Middling,"
replies Mr. George, taking a chair.
"Your granddaughter I've had the honour of seeing before. My service to you, miss."
"This is my grandson," says Grandfather Smallweed. "You ain't seen him before. He is in the law, and not much at home."
"My service to him, too. He's like his sister. He's very like his sister. He is devilish like his sister,"
says Mr. George, laying a great and not altogether complimentary stress on his last adjective.
"And how does the world use you, Mr. George?"
Grandfather Smallweed inquires, slowly rubbing his legs.
"Pretty much as usual. Like a football."
He's a swarthy brown man of 50, well-made and good-looking, with crisp dark hair, bright eyes, and a broad chest. His sinewy and powerful hands, as sunburnt as his face, have evidently been used to a pretty rough life. What is curious about him is that he sits forward on his chair as if he were, from long habit, allowing space for some dress or accoutrements that he has altogether laid aside. His step, too, is measured and heavy, and would go well with a weighty clash and jingle of spurs. He is close-shaved now, but his mouth is set as if his upper lip had been for years familiar with a great moustache, and his manner of occasionally laying the open palm of his broad brown hand upon it is to the same effect. Altogether, one might guess Mr. George to have been a trooper once upon a time. A special contrast Mr. George makes to the Smallweed family. Trooper was never yet billeted upon a household more unlike him. It is a broadsword to an oyster knife. His developed figure and their stunted forms, his large manner filling any amount of room and their little narrow pinched ways, his sounding voice and their sharp spare tones are in the strongest and the strangest opposition. As he sits in the middle of the grim parlour, leaning a little forward with his hands upon his thighs and his elbows squared, he looks as though, if he remained there long, he would absorb into himself the whole family, and the whole four-roomed house, extra little back kitchen and all.
"'Do you rub your legs to rub life into em?'
he asks of Grandfather Smallweed after looking round the room.
"'Why, it's partly a habit, Mr. George, and yes, it partly helps the circulation,' he replies.
"'The circulation,'
repeats Mr. George, folding his arms upon his chest and seeming to become two sizes larger.
"'Not much of that, I should think.'
"'Truly, I'm old, Mr. George,' says Grandfather Smallweed, "'but I can carry my years. "'I'm older than her,' nodding at his wife, "'and see what she is. "'You're a brimstone chatterer,' with a sudden revival of his late hostility.
"'Unlucky old soul,'
says Mr. George, turning his head in that direction.
"'Don't scold the old lady. Look at her here.' "'with her poor cap half off her head, "'and her poor hair all in a muddle. "'Hold up, ma'am. "'That's better. "'There we are. "'Think of your mother, Mr. Smallweed,' "'says Mr. George, "'coming back to his seat from assisting her. "'If your wife ain't enough.'
"'I suppose you were an excellent son, Mr. George,' "'the old man hints with a leer.
"'The colour of Mr. George's face rather deepens as he replies,
"'Why, no, I wasn't.
"'I'm astonished at it.
"'So am I. "'I ought to have been a good son, "'and I think I meant to have been one, but I wasn't. "'I was a thundering bad son, that's the long and the short of it, "'and never was a credit to anybody.'
"'Surprising!' cries the old man.
"'However,' Mr. George resumes, "'the less said about it, the better now. "'Come, you know the agreement?' "'Always a pipe out of the 2 months' interest. "'Bosh, it's all correct. "'You needn't be afraid to order the pipe. "'Here's the new bill, and here's the 2 months' interest money, "'and a devil and all of a scrape it is to get it together in my business.'
"'Mr. George sits with his arms folded, consuming the family and the parlour, "'while Grandfather Smallweed is assisted by Judy "'to two black leathern cases out of a locked bureau.' In one of which he secures the document he has just received, and from the other takes another similar document which he hands to Mr. George, who twists it up for a pipe light. As the old man inspects, through his glasses, every upstroke and downstroke of both documents before he releases them from their leathern prison, and as he counts the money three times over, and requires Judy to say every word she utters at least twice, and is as tremulously slow of speech and action as it is possible to be, this business is a long time in progress. When it is quite concluded, and not before, he disengages his ravenous eyes and fingers from it, and answers Mr. George's last remark by saying,
"'Afraid to order the pipe? We are not so mercenary as that, sir. Judy, you see directly to the pipe and a glass of cold brandy and water for Mr. George.'
The sportive twins, who have been looking straight before them all this time, except when they have been engrossed by the black leathern cases, retire together, generally disdainful of the visitor, but leaving him to the old man as two young cubs might leave a traveller to the parental bear.
"'And there you sit, I suppose, all the day long, eh?'
says Mr. George, with folded arms.
"'Just so, just so,'
the old man nods.
"'And don't you occupy yourself at all?'
"'I watch the fire. "'And the boiling, and the roasting.'
"'When there is any,'
says Mr. George, with great expression.
"'Just so, when there is any.'
"'Don't you read or get read too?'
The old man shakes his head with sharp, sly triumph.
"'Nope, nope. We have never been readers in our family. It don't pay. Stuff, idleness, folly, no, no.'
"'There's not much to choose between your two states,'
says the visitor, in a key too low for the old man's dull hearing as he looks from him to the old woman and back again.
"'I say,'
in a louder voice,
"'I hear you.
"'You'll sell me up at last, I suppose, when I'm a day in arrear.'
"'My dear friend,' cries Grandfather Smallweed, stretching out both hands to embrace him, "'never, never, my dear friend.' "'But my friend in the city that I got to lend you the money, he might.'
"'Oh, you can't answer for him,'
says Mr. George, finishing the inquiry in his lower key with the words,
"'You lying old rascal!'
"'My dear friend, he is not to be depended on. "'I wouldn't trust him. "'He will have his bond, my dear friend.'
"'Devil doubt him!'
says Mr. George. Charlie, appearing with a tray on which are the pipe, "'a small paper of tobacco and the brandy and water, "'he asks her,
"'How do you come here? "'You haven't got the family face, sir.'
"'I goes out to work, sir,'
returns Charlie. The trooper, if trooper he be or have been, takes her bonnet off with a light touch for so strong a hand and pats her on the head.
"'You give the house almost a wholesome look. It wants a bit of youth as much as it wants fresh air.'
Then he dismisses her, lights his pipe, and drinks to Mr. Smallweed's friend in the city, the one solitary flight of that esteemed old gentleman's imagination.
"'So you think he might be hard upon me, eh?'
"'I think he might. I am afraid he would. I have known him do it,' says Grandfather Smallweed incautiously, 20 times.'
Incautiously, because his stricken better half, who has been dozing over the fire for some time, is instantly aroused and jabbers,
£20,000, 20 £20 notes in a money-box, 20 guineas, 20 million, 20%, 20...
and is then cut short by the flying cushion, which the visitor, to whom this singular experiment appears to be a novelty, snatches from her face as it crushes her in the usual manner.
"'You're a brimstone idiot, you're a scorpion, a brimstone scorpion, you're a sweltering toad, you're a chattering, clattering broomstick witch that ought to be burnt!'
gasps the old man, prostrate in his chair.
"'My dear friend, will you shake me up a little?'
Mr. George, who has been looking first at one of them and then at the other, as if he were demented, takes his venerable acquaintance by the throat on receiving this request, and dragging him upright in his chair as easily as if he were a doll, appears in two minds whether or no to shake all future power of cushioning out of him, and shake him into his grave. Resisting the temptation, but agitating him violently enough to make his head roll like a harlequin's, he puts him smartly down in his chair again and adjusts his skull-cap with such a rub that the old man winks with both eyes for a minute afterwards.
"'Oh, Lord!' gasps Mr. Smallweed. "'That'll do. Thank you, my dear friend. That'll do. Oh, dear me, I'm out of breath. Oh, Lord!'
And Mr. Smallweed says it not without evident apprehensions of his dear friend, who still stands over him, looming larger than ever. The alarming presence, however, gradually subsides into its chair, and falls to smoking in long puffs, consoling itself with the philosophical reflection,
"'The name of your friend in the city begins with a D, comrade, and you're about right respecting the bond.'
"'Did you speak, Mr. George?' inquires the old man.
The trooper shakes his head, and leaning forward with his right elbow on his right knee, and his pipe supported in that hand, while his other hand resting on his left leg squares his left elbow in a martial manner, continues to smoke. Meanwhile he looks at Mr. Smallweed with grave attention, and now and then fans the cloud of smoke away, in order that he may see him the more clearly.
"'I take it,'
he says, making just as much and as little change in his position as will enable him to reach the glass to his lips with a round full action,
"'that I am the only man alive, or dead either, that gets the value of a pipe out of you.'
"'Well,' returns the old man, "'it's true that I don't see company, Mr. George, and that I don't treat. I can't afford to it. But as you, in your pleasant way, made your pipe a condition—'
"'Why, it's not for the value of it. That's no great thing. It was a fancy to get it out of you.' They have something in for my money.
"'Ah, you're prudent. Prudent, sir,'
cries Grandfather Smallweed, rubbing his legs.
"'Very. I always was.'
Puff.
"'It's a sure sign of my prudence that I ever found the way here.'
Puff.
"'Also, that I am what I am.'
Puff.
"'I'm well known to be prudent,'
says Mr. George, composedly smoking.
"'I rose in life that way.'
"'Don't be down-hearted, sir. You may rise yet.'
Mr. George laughs and drinks.
"'Ain't you no relations now?'
asks Grandfather Smallweed, with a twinkle in his eyes.
who would pay off this little principal? Or who would lend you a good name or two that I could persuade my friend in the city to make you a further advance upon? Two good names would be sufficient for my friend in the city. Ain't you no such relations, Mr. George?
Mr. George, still composedly smoking, replies,
If I had, I shouldn't trouble them. I've been troubled enough to my belongings in my day. It may be a very good sort of penitence in a vagabond who has wasted the best time of his life, to go back then to decent people that he never was a credit to, and live upon them. But it's not my sort. The best kind of amends, then, for having gone away, is to keep away, in my opinion.
But natural affection, Mr. George, hints Grandfather Smallweed.
For two good names, hey?
Says Mr. George, shaking his head and still composedly smoking.
No, that's not my sort either.
Grandfather Smallweed has been gradually sliding down in his chair since his last adjustment, and is now a bundle of clothes, with a voice in it calling for Judy. That houri, appearing, shakes him up in the usual manner, and is charged by the old gentleman to remain near him, for he seems chary of putting his visitor to the trouble of repeating his late attentions.
Ah, he observes when he is in trim again, if you could have traced out the captain, Mr. George, it would have been the making of you. If, when you first came here in consequence of our advertisement in the newspapers, when I say our, I'm alluding to the advertisements of my friend in the city and one or two others who embark their capital in the same way, and are so friendly towards me as sometimes to give me a lift with my little pittance, if at that time you could have helped us, Mr. George, it would have been the making of you.
I was willing enough to be made, as you call it,
says Mr. George, smoking not quite so placidly as before, for since the entrance of Judy he has been in some measure disturbed by a fascination, not of the admiring kind, which obliges him to look at her as she stands by her grandfather's chair.
But on the whole, I'm glad I wasn't now.
Why, Mr. George, in the name of Brimstone, why?
Says Grandfather Smallweed, with a plain appearance of exasperation. Brimstone apparently suggested by his eye lighting on Mrs. Smallweed in her slumber.
For two reasons, comrade.
And what two reasons, Mr. George, in the name of the...
Of our friend in the city,
suggests Mr. George, composedly drinking.
Aye, if you like, what two reasons?
In the first place,
returns Mr. George, but still looking at Judy as if she being so old and so like her grandfather, it is indifferent which of the two he addresses.
You gentlemen took me in. You advertised that Mr. Horden, Captain Horden, if you hold to the saying, once a captain, always a captain, was to hear of something to his advantage.
Well,
returns the old man shrilly and sharply.
Well,
says Mr. George, smoking on.
It wouldn't have been much to his advantage to have been clapped into prison by the whole bill and judgment trade of London.
Had you know that, some of his rich relations might have paid his debts or compounded for him. Besides, he had taken us in. He owed us immense sums all round. I would sooner have strangled him than had no return. If I sit here thinking of him,
snarls the old man, holding up his impotent 10 fingers,
I want to strangle him now.
And in a sudden access of fury, he throws the cushion at the unoffending Mrs. Smallweed, but it passes harmlessly on one side of her chair.
"I don't need to be told,"
returns the trooper, taking his pipe from his lips for a moment and carrying his eyes back from following the progress of the cushion to the pipe bowl, which is burning low,
"that he carried on heavily and went to ruin. I've been at his right hand many a day when he was charging upon ruin full gallop. I was with him when he was sick and well, rich and poor. I laid this hand upon him after he had run through everything and broken down everything beneath him when he held a pistol to his head.
I wish he had let it off,
says the benevolent old man, and blown his head into as many pieces as he owed pounds.
That would have been a smash indeed,
returns the trooper coolly.
Anyway, he had been young, hopeful, and handsome in the days gone by, and I'm glad I never found him when he was neither, to lead to a result so much to his advantage. That's reason number one.
I hope number two's as good,
snarls the old man.
"'Why, no. It's more of a selfish reason. "'If I had found him, I must have gone to the other world to look. "'He was there.'
"'How do you know he was there?'
"'He wasn't here.'
"'How do you know he wasn't here?'
"'Don't lose your temper as well as your money,'
says Mr. George, "'calmly knocking the ashes out of his pipe.
"'He was drowned long before. "'I'm convinced of it. "'He went over a ship's side. "'Whether intentionally or accidentally, I don't know.' Perhaps your friend in the city does. Do you know what that tune is, Mr. Smallweed?
He adds, after breaking off to whistle one, accompanied on the table with the empty pipe.
Tune? Replied the old man. No, we never have tunes here.
That's the Dead March in Saul. They bury soldiers to it, so it's the natural end of the subject. Now, if your pretty granddaughter, excuse me, miss, will condescend to take care of this pipe for 2 months, we shall save the cost of one next time. Good evening, Mr. Smallweed.
My dear friend.
The old man gives him both his hands.
So you think your friend in the city will be hard upon me if I fail in a payment?
Says the trooper, looking down upon him like a giant.
My dear friend, I'm afraid he will, returns the old man, looking up at him like a pygmy.
Mr. George laughs, and with a glance at Mr. Smallweed and a parting salutation to the scornful Judy, strides out of the parlour, clashing imaginary sabres and other metallic appurtenances as he goes.
"'You're a damned rogue,'
says the old gentleman, making a hideous grimace at the door as he shuts it.
"'But I'll lime you, you dog! I'll lime you!'
After this amiable remark, his spirit soars into those enchanting regions of reflection which its education and pursuits have opened to it, and again he and Mrs. Smallweed while away the rosy hours, two unrelieved sentinels forgotten as aforesaid by the black sergeant. While the twain are faithful to their post, Mr. George strides through the streets with a massive kind of swagger and a grave enough face. It is 8 o'clock now, and the day is fast drawing in. He stops hard by Waterloo Bridge and reads a playbill, decides to go to Astley's Theatre. Being there is much delighted with the horses and the feats of strength, looks at the weapons with a critical eye, disapproves of the combats as giving evidences of unskilful swordsmanship, but is touched home by the sentiments. In the last scene, when the Emperor of Tartary gets up into a cart and condescends to bless the united lovers by hovering over them with the Union Jack, his eyelashes are moistened with emotion. The theatre over, Mr. George comes across the water again and makes his way to that curious region lying about the Haymarket and Leicester Square, which is a centre of attraction to indifferent foreign hotels and indifferent foreigners, racket courts, fighting men, swordsmen, foot guards, old china, gaming houses, exhibitions, and a large medley of shabbiness and shrinking out of sight. Penetrating to the heart of this region, he arrives by a court and a long whitewashed passage at a great brick building composed of bare walls, floors, roof rafters, and skylights, on the front of which, if it can be said to have any front, is painted George's Shooting Gallery, etc. Into George's Shooting Gallery, etc. he goes, and in it there are gaslights, partly turned off now, and two whitened targets for rifle shooting and archery accommodation, and fencing appliances and all necessaries for the British art of boxing. None of these sports or exercises being pursued in George's Shooting Gallery tonight, which is so devoid of company that a little grotesque man with a large head has it all to himself, and lies asleep upon the floor. The little man is dressed something like a gunsmith, in a green baize apron and cap, and his face and hands are dirty with gunpowder and begrimed with the loading of guns. As he lies in the light before a glaring white target, the black upon him shines again. Not far off is the strong, rough, primitive table with a vice upon it, at which he has been working. He is a little man, with a face all crushed together, who appears, from a certain blue and speckled appearance that one of his cheeks presents, to have been blown up in the way of business at some odd time or times.
"Phil,"
says the trooper in a quiet voice.
"All right,"
cries Phil, scrambling to his feet.
"Anything been doing?"
"Flat as ever so much swipes," says Phil. 5 dozen rifle and 12 pistol. As to aim..."
Phil gives a howl at the recollection.
"Shut up, shop, Phil."
As Phil moves about to execute this order, it appears that he is lame, though able to move very quickly. On the speckled side of his face he has no eyebrow, and on the other side he has a bushy black one, which want of uniformity gives him a very singular and rather sinister appearance. Everything seems to have happened to his hands that could possibly take place consistently with the retention of all the fingers, for they are notched and seamed and crumpled all over. He appears to be very strong, and lifts heavy benches about as if he had no idea what weight was. He has a curious way of limping round the gallery with his shoulder against the wall, and tacking off at objects he wants to lay hold of instead of going straight to them, which has left a smear all round the four walls, conventionally called Phil's Mark. This custodian of George's gallery, in George's absence, concludes his proceedings, when he has locked the great doors and turned out all the lights but one, which he leaves to glimmer, by dragging out from a wooden cabin in a corner two mattresses and bedding. These being drawn to opposite ends of the gallery, the trooper makes his own bed, and Phil makes his.
"Phil!"
says the master, walking towards him without his coat and waistcoat, and looking more soldierly than ever in his braces.
"You were found in a doorway, weren't you?"
"Gutter," says Phil. "Watchman tumbled over me."
"Then vagabondizing came natural to you from the beginning."
"As natural as possible," says Phil.
"Good night."
"Good night, Governor."
Phil cannot even go straight to bed, but finds it necessary to shoulder round two sides of the gallery, and then tack off at his mattress. The trooper, after taking a turn or two in the rifle distance, and looking up at the moon now shining through the skylights, strides to his own mattress by a shorter route, and goes to bed too. Chapter 22. Mr. Bucket. Allegory looks pretty cool in Lincoln's Inn Fields, though the evening is hot, for both Mr. Tulkinghorn's windows are wide open, and the room is lofty, gusty, and gloomy. These may not be desirable characteristics when November comes with fog and sleet, or January with ice and snow, but they have their merits in the sultry long vacation weather. They enable Allegory, though it has cheeks like peaches and knees like bunches of blossoms, and rosy swellings for calves to its legs and muscles to its arms, to look tolerably cool tonight. Plenty of dust comes in at Mr. Tulkinghorn's windows, and plenty more has generated among his furniture and papers. It lies thick everywhere. When a breeze from the country that has lost its way takes fright, and makes a blind hurry to rush out again, it flings as much dust in the eyes of Allegory as the law, or Mr. Tulkinghorn, one of its trustiest representatives, may scatter on occasion in the eyes of the laity. In his lowering magazine of dust, the universal article into which his papers and himself and all his clients, and all things of earth, animate and inanimate, are resolving, Mr. Tulkinghorn sits at one of the open windows enjoying a bottle of old port. Though a hard-grained man, close, dry and silent, he can enjoy old wine with the best. He has a priceless bin of port in some artful cellar under the fields, which is one of his many secrets. When he dines alone in chambers, as he has dined today, and has his bit of fish and his steak or chicken brought in from the coffee-house, he descends with a candle to the echoing regions below the deserted mansion, and heralded by a remote reverberation of thundering doors, comes gravely back encircled by an earthy atmosphere, and carrying a bottle from which he pours a radiant nectar, 70 years old, that blushes in the glass to find itself so famous, and fills the whole room with the fragrance of southern grapes. Mr. Tulkinghorn, sitting in the twilight by the open window, enjoys his wine. As if it whispered to him of its 50 years of silence and seclusion, it shuts him up the closer. More impenetrable than ever he sits and drinks, and mellows as it were in secrecy, pondering at that twilight hour on all the mysteries he knows, associated with darkening woods in the country, and vast blank shut-up houses in town, and perhaps sparing a thought or two for himself, and his family history, and his money, and his will, all a mystery to everyone, and that one bachelor friend of his, a man of the same mould and a lawyer too, who lived the same kind of life until he was 75 years old, and then suddenly conceiving, as it is supposed, an impression that it was too monotonous, gave his gold watch to his hairdresser one summer evening, and walked leisurely home to the Temple and hanged himself. But Mr. Tulkinghorn is not alone tonight to ponder at his usual length. Seated at the same table, though with his chair modestly and uncomfortably drawn a little way from it, sits a bald, mild, shining man who coughs respectfully behind his hand when the lawyer bids him fill his glass.
"Now, Snagsby," says Mr. Tulkinghorn, "to go over this odd story again, if you please, sir. You told me when you were so good as to step round here last night, for which I must ask you to excuse me if it was a liberty, sir, but I remember that you had taken a sort of an interest in that person, and I thought it possible that you might just wish to—" Mr. Tulkinghorn is not the man to help him to any conclusion, or to admit anything as to any possibility concerning himself. So Mr. Snagsby trails off into saying, with an awkward cough, "I must ask you to excuse the liberty, sir, I'm sure." "Not at all," says Mr. Tulkinghorn. "You told me, Snagsby, that you put on your hat and came round without mentioning your intention to your wife. That was prudent, I think, because it's not a matter of such importance that it requires to be mentioned."
"Well, sir," returns Mr. Snagsby, "you see, my little woman is, not to put too fine a point upon it, inquisitive. She's inquisitive, poor little thing. She's liable to spasms, and it's good for her to have her mind employed, in consequence of which she employs it, I should say, upon every individual thing she can lay hold of, whether it concerns her or not. Especially not. My little woman has a very active mind, sir."
Mr. Snagsby drinks and murmurs with an admiring cough behind his hand, "Dear me, very fine wine indeed."
"Therefore you kept your visit to yourself last night," says Mr. Tulkinghorn. "And tonight, too?"
"Yes, sir, and tonight, too. My little woman is at present in, not to put too fine a point on it, in a pious state, or in what she considers such, and attends the evening exertions, which is the name they go by, of a reverend party of the name of Chadband. He has a great deal of eloquence at his command, undoubtedly, but I am not quite favourable to his style myself. That's neither here nor there. My little woman, being engaged in that way, made it easier for me to step round in a quiet manner."
Mr. Tulkinghorn assents.
"Fill your glass, Snagsby."
"Thank you, sir, I'm sure," returns the stationer with his cough of deference. "This is wonderfully fine wine, sir."
"It is a rare wine now," says Mr. Tulkinghorn. "It is 50 years old."
"Is it indeed, sir?
Well, I'm not surprised to hear it, I'm sure. It might be any age, almost."
After rendering this general tribute to the port, Mr. Snagsby, in his modesty, coughs an apology behind his hand for drinking anything so precious.
"Will you run over, once again, what the boy said?" asks Mr. Tulkinghorn, putting his hands into the pockets of his rusty small clothes and leaning quietly back in his chair.
"With pleasure, sir."
Then, with fidelity, though with some prolixity, the law stationer repeats Joe's statement made to the assembled guests at his house. On coming to the end of his narrative, he gives a great start and breaks off with,
"Dear me, sir, I wasn't aware there was any other gentleman present."
Mr. Snagsby is dismayed to see, standing with an attentive face between himself and the lawyer at a little distance from the table, a person with a hat and stick in his hand, who was not there when he himself came in, and has not since entered by the door or by either of the windows. There is a press in the room, but its hinges have not creaked, nor has a step been audible upon the floor. Yet this person stands there with his attentive face, and his hat and stick in his hands, and his hands behind him, a composed and quiet listener. He is a stoutly built, steady-looking, sharp-eyed man in black, of about the middle age. Except that he looks at Mr. Snagsby as if he were going to take his portrait, there is nothing remarkable about him at first sight but his ghostly manner of appearing.
"I don't mind this gentleman," says Mr. Tulkinghorn in his quiet way. "This is only Mr. Bucket."
"Oh, indeed, sir,"
returns the stationer, expressing by a cough that he is quite in the dark as to who Mr. Bucket may be.
"I wanted him to hear this story," says the lawyer, "because I have half a mind, for a reason, to know more of it, and he is very intelligent in such things. What do you say to this, Bucket?"
"It's very plain, sir, since our people have moved this boy on, and he's not to be found on his old lay, if Mr. Snagsby don't object to go down with me to Tom or Alone's and point him out, we can have him here in less than a couple of hours' time. I can do it without Mr. Snagsby, of course, but this is the shortest way."
"Mr. Bucket is a detective officer, Snagsby," says the lawyer in explanation.
"Is he indeed, sir?"
says Mr. Snagsby, with a strong tendency in his clump of hair to stand on end.
"And if you have no real objection to accompany Mr. Bucket to the place in question," pursues the lawyer, "I shall feel obliged to you if you will do so."
In a moment's hesitation on the part of Mr. Snagsby, Bucket dips down to the bottom of his mind.
"Don't you be afraid of hurting the boy," he says. "You won't do that. It's all right as far as the boy's concerned. We shall only bring him here to ask him a question or so I want to put to him, and he'll be paid for his trouble and sent away again. It'll be a good job for him. I promise you as a man that you shall see the boy sent away all right. Don't you be afraid of hurting him. You ain't going to do that."
"Very well, Mr. Tarkinghorn," cries Mr. Snagsby cheerfully, and reassured, "since that's the case." "Yes, and looky here, Mr. Snagsby," resumes Bucket, taking him aside by the arm, tapping him familiarly on the breast, and speaking in a confidential tone. "You're a man of the world, you know, and a man of business, and a man of sense. That's what you are."
"I'm sure I'm much obliged to you for your good opinion," returns the stationer with his cough of modesty. "But
that's what you are, you know," says Bucket. "Now, it ain't necessary to say to a man like you. Engaged in your business, which is a business of trust, and requires a person to be wide awake and